Hanukkah is a good time to talk about a subject that we, I don't think we've looked at before, and that is the question and the problem of happiness. Happiness, simcha, what we call simcha. Depression also could be understood possibly from the correct approach to the Jewish view or understanding of this subject. It's a difficult area. There's a lot of components. Let's try and work together, concentrate together, and try to work out the subject. It's worth the effort, because a lot of the secret to success in life in general, certainly from a Jewish or Torah perspective, is located in this, in the correct understanding of the subject. Let's ask a few questions about happiness and see then if we can develop a mature and correct understanding of the subject from a Torah perspective. First of all, is it a mitzvah to be happy? Are we commanded to be happy? Let's understand that. Is it a formal commandment to be happy? You'll notice if you look through the formulation of the 613 mitzvahs, in any count that you care to study, there are different ways of counting the mitzvahs, you will not find it a commandment to be happy. You'll not find it stated anywhere that it's the obligation of a Jew to be happy. At least you won't find it as one of the commandments. And yet, paradoxically, there are statements within the Jewish tradition that make it sound like you are obliged to be happy. For example, and each of them is problematic. For example, the verse says, there's a pasuk, a verse that says, Ivdu es Hashem besimcha, which means, serve God, serve Hashem with happiness. And some even interpret that verse to mean, you serve Him by being happy. The service, the happiness is the work itself. Now, the problem is like this. First of all, what does that statement mean? If it's not a mitzvah, if it's not formulated as a mitzvah, then why is there a statement in the Torah that says that you have to do this? Apart from the problem of how do you be happy, and how can you be commanded to be happy in the first place? Let's bypass that for the moment. What does the statement mean that says you have to serve in happiness if in fact it's not one of the mitzvahs? That needs thought. Secondly, there's a verse in the Torah that's even more problematic, and it says as follows. Now, the Torah describes the curses that will befall the Jewish people if we are defaulting on our obligations. Right? The Torah, in a couple of places, goes through a series of the most horrific Holocaust type of curses that will befall the Jewish people when we default on our on our obligations. And there the Torah lists 98 or 99 or 100 of the most unspeakable and brutal sufferings that the Jewish people, unfortunately we've been through all of them. They sound extreme, but we've been through all of them. That is what we'll go through. But what's completely unintelligible is that after the Torah goes through a whole list of these most awesome curses, it gives what purports to be a reason, what appears to be a reason, why the Jewish people will be visited with this intensity of difficulties and brutalities. It gives what appears to be a reason. And it says as follows, Tachas es asher loy ovadatas Hashem alokecha besimcha. Because you did not serve Hashem with simcha. Now, let's just get clear what's being said. There's a description, a list of the most horrific curses, and then, as if to give a reason why you will be cursed like this, why you'll be brutalized like this, because you didn't serve Hashem in happiness. Simply understood, it appears to mean you weren't happy. That you're going to go through these tortures because you were not happy. You didn't work on being happy. Is that possible? Is it possible that we went through these indescribably brutal tortures throughout history because we weren't happy? And if it is true, then why is it not formulated as a mitzvah? Again, it's a problematic area. Let's go a little further. Let's assume for a moment that you ask about... You know, we have a folk saying even among the Jewish people, mitzvah gedolah. You must have heard this. It's been put to any number of tunes, Mitzvah Gedola Liyos Basimcha Tomit. Listen carefully. It's a great mitzvah to be happy always. You know, here when it says it's a mitzvah, it doesn't mean a formal mitzvah. You know, there are two usages of the word mitzvah. One is a technical word, which means one of the 613 mitzvahs. But then there's a broader concept that we call mitzvah, which means it's a thing you should do. No doubt it can be traced formally to one of the mitzvahs, but it's a broader sense of, it's used in a broader sense. Mitzvah, that's a great mitzvah, that means it's something you certainly should work on, something you certainly should do. Liyos besimcha tomit, to be happy always. Now what's challenging about that statement is the word always. How can you be happy always? How can you possibly be happy always? What does it mean? We don't do things, we don't use words loosely. In the Jewish tradition, if there's one thing we're accurate about, it's using words correctly. How can you be happy always? What about mourning, Leilani? What about mourning? You have to sit on the cry, the times you have to sit on the floor and cry. When somebody, Leilani, has died. There's a mitzvah to sit on the floor. And there's a mitzvah, certainly there's a mitzvah of mourning. I don't know about a mitzvah of happiness, but there's certainly a mitzvah of mourning. So how can you be happy always? Fourth question. In case you think it's, you know, a misprint or it's a... The Chazon Ish, great leader of the previous generation, the great leader of Jewry in the previous generation, the Chazon Ish died in 1953. He writes in one of his letters, it's worth looking up yourself because it's absolutely, almost no words for this. He writes the following thing. I don't know what the question was. Somebody must have written to him with the personal difficulties, I suppose. The question is not recorded. Somebody must have written to him suffering or going through difficulties. Chazon Ish writes an answer. The answer is like one or two lines long. You can look it up yourself. It's in the collected edition of his personal writings and letters. It's number 62 or 63, Samach Gimel, somewhere around there, in the letters of the Chazon Ish. He makes the following statement. Just listen carefully to these words. I'm paraphrasing slightly, but to this effect. For somebody who knows the light of the lights of truth, for such a person, whatever the light of the lights of truth is, let's translate it roughly in English as for somebody who knows what's going on here. If you know what life's all about, for such a person, ein etzev ba'olam. You know what those words mean? There's no sadness in the world. There's no sadness in the world. How can a person say that? How can a person say that? The Chazon Ish himself went through his own personal tragedies. He lived through the war. He had his own personal... He bore the responsibility and the weight and the pain of the Jewish people on his shoulders. How can a man say that? What do you mean there's no sadness in the world? He forgot about sitting on the floor and crying in mourning? He forgot about that? You know, you can be upbeat and you can be positive, but a statement like that, ein etzev ba'olam, how can you say that? Now, he's telling you that if you understand what life's all about, you will never be in a situation of etzev, which in English is described as sadness, depression, depressive sadness, whatever. But whatever that emotion is, whatever the correct English translation is, that will never be experienced by somebody who knows what's going on, despite anything that you may ever have to cope with or live through. What on earth does that mean? How is that possible? How could he say such a thing? Next question. Let's assume for a moment you're supposed to be happy. How can you be happy in a world like this? How can you be happy in a world like this? The world is full of intense suffering. Intense suffering. How are you supposed to be happy? You're going to go out with some friends. What's your idea of happiness? You're going to go out with some friends. You're going to talk about whatever it is you talk about. Have some food. I don't know, whatever it is. Some music in the background. I don't know. Add everything in that you want. You're going to sit there and be happy. But there are people not far away who are going through the most unspeakable pain. But how can you be happy when that's going on? How many people do you have to know? How many people do you have to know who are going through torture? Psychological, marital, physical. How many people like that do you have to know before it affects your ability to go out and have a good time? Is there anybody who doesn't know somebody like that? Isn't there somebody in your family or somebody connected to your family who isn't dying of who knows what? How many people like that do you have to be aware of before it affects you? So how are you supposed to have a good time? You know, there's only two possibilities. Either you go out and you have a good time, which means you forget about them. Is that what Judaism requires? That you should be so insensitive that you can actually forget about somebody you know who's going through some, and you can ignore that and forget about it and be happy and have a good time? Is that what's expected of us being Jewish? Well, the only other option, if you think about it logically, is that you don't forget about them. So how are you supposed to have a good time if you don't? You're supposed to have a good time while remembering that they're going through torture. You sit there giggling and laughing. while being aware that this person is dying in pain, that's even more insensitive. Even one person on earth who's going through some human, deep human suffering, even one person that you know about should be enough to make you absolutely mortified. You shouldn't be able to go out and have a good time at all if you have real sensitivity. And believe me, there's not one person out there. There's hundreds of thousands of millions of people. So what's going on? What is going on? What does the Torah want from us? It wants us to be happy or doesn't. You know, if you look at the secular culture that we live in, and you ask what is the purpose of life? What's the purpose of life? What are you supposed to be here for? What are you here for exactly? Judaism has answers to that question. But what is the secular culture? Let's try and see if we can draw a distinction, a clarity of distinction between our definition of what life's all about and theirs. I would guess, I would hazard a guess, I wouldn't be stubborn about it and I'm not about to argue with you, but I would hazard a guess that if you examine the culture in which we live and you look at its literature and its expression, you'll probably find that their idea of the purpose of being here is to be happy. The goal of their lives, I would guess probably, if you look through the literature of Western culture, you probably find that the drive is happiness, or achieving the means to be happy. Ultimately, it's to be happy. I think you could make a very good case for that premise. We have an explicit tradition in Judaism that we're not here to be happy. Not at all. I'm trying to show you that it's the means, but it's certainly not the end. And by them, secular culture, I think it is the end. And the problem is, if that's the end, you're doomed to failure. Doomed to failure because you cannot possibly be happy. The world is just too brutal and it's too sad. And even if you're having a good time, you're aware that the best times are the soonest over. The moments of the most intense happiness and pleasure are the ones that die instantly. You cannot prolong them. The only way they can achieve it is by becoming drunk, one way or another. You either have to do it literally so that you know the way of suffering, or you have to do it emotionally. You have to do something to yourself so that you become unaware. That's not Judaism. Judaism requires a hyper-sensitive and hyper-aware consciousness at all times. We're super-conscious people. We don't forget anything. So we have a problem. We have a problem. We have a problem. Did I convince you that you have a problem? Yes? What is the Jewish approach to this question? What does happiness mean to us? Let's try and work it out together. It's one of the most important, possibly the most important subject, understood correctly. Let's try and stay together and work it out. I hope to be able to share with you an insight into this area, which is remarkable. Happiness is as follows. The correct understanding of happiness is this. Listen well, because this definition must take us through the whole discussion. Stay with me carefully. Happiness is the experience of the soul to doing what it should be doing. Again, listen well. Happiness is the result of doing what you're supposed to be doing, what you should be doing. Again, when you're doing what you should be doing, when you're moving along the road that you should be moving along, the response is happiness. Happiness is not something you can do. It's a response to a situation. The situation is a situation of growth and development. When you're moving correctly along the correct road to the correct goal, you will be happy. It's got nothing to do with whether the road is easy or difficult, and it has nothing to do with the expression on your face. On the contrary, when the expression on your face is perhaps the most contorted with pain and effort, some of those experiences are the most happy experiences that there could be. Stay with me. If you've ever lived, if you ever really lived, you already know exactly what's meant. But for those of you who haven't lived, let's try and work it out more fully. Again, our concept of happiness, and I'll try to show you that it's naturally derived. This is not some esoteric or abstract concept. Our concept of happiness is that it's the response of your inner being to the situation of being where you should be, doing what you should be doing. And it makes no difference whether your face is laughing, expression on the face is laughter and happiness, or the expression on the face is the weeping of mourning. The inner expansion, the inner change, the inner experience, the transcendent experience of the soul, if what that action is correct, whether it's sitting on the floor weeping or it's laughing, right, at a simcha, if that's what you have to be doing, the inner experience will be that which we call simcha. Stay with me carefully, let's try to work it out. And I'd like to show you that it's not only irrelevant to expression on the face, it's particularly when the expression on the face is difficult, particularly when the outer expression is one of difficulty and ordeal. Particularly then, the inner expansion can be the most... In depth, that's where the real simcha is. Right? That sounds paradoxical. Let's try to... It's not a popular message in this generation. It's got nothing to do with drunkenness and forgetfulness and insensitivity. Nothing like that at all. But it's the Jewish view, and let's try to understand. Real sadness, by the way, is when you don't know which road you're supposed to be on. You can be sitting in the sun and drinking whatever it is that you drink, and you can, but if you're on the wrong road or you don't know which road you should be on, you're going to be miserable. Miserable. Everybody might be giggling around you. And you're going to be sitting in the lap of luxury, but if you're not moving along the road that you know you need to be moving along and time is ticking by, the neshama will become depressed. Let's try to understand this. First of all, let me try and show you, before we fill it out and explore it thoroughly, let me try to show you why it is that when you're doing what you have to be doing, even when it's difficult, the experience is one of happiness. It's nothing to do with forgetfulness. Let me try and demonstrate that. That's the first component. Imagine you have to build something. Imagine you have to build something. And it's going to take tremendous effort, right? You have to build something over there, and you've got to carry heavy rocks and logs in the hot sun, and you have to build this thing. But what you're building is very important. And you have a time limit on building that thing. You have a certain number of hours, and by that time it has to be built. But if you manage it in the time, the result will be fantastic. It'll have tremendous repercussions. It'll be an enormous thing. And you'd have to do this single-handedly. And you labor in the sun, and you're grunting and sweating and groaning with the pain, and your muscles are aching, and your bones feel like it. And you're moving these logs, and you're building this thing. What do you experience at the moment when in the middle of your work you suddenly realize, right, you realize that you're going to make it? That the thing is taking shape, and you're moving ahead of the clock, right? And you realize that you're going to make it. What is the experience in your heart as that is being done? There's an exhilaration, that's what you feel. There's a tremendous simcha. Would I know it from the expression on your face? The expression on your face is one of utter pain, abject terror, pain, brutality, suffering, torture, that's what it looks like, right? You're grunting, you may be weeping with exertion. You may be weeping with exertion, but your heart is singing within you because... I don't see too many enlightened faces. Let's try another example. Imagine you come from Mars. Huh? And you've never seen a human being before. Now you're very interested to take a tour of the human race. You want to know what all this is about. So you take this, you have this visitor from Mars, so you take him to see what mankind's all about. The first place you happen to take this individual is to a gymnasium. You know, those places, none of you would ever enter a place like that, but you know where they pick up weights and work on these machines? But you get places like that, not so far away even. You get places like that, right? Now, this Martian looks through the keyhole of this place, and he sees a young man working on one of these machines, right? He's picking up weights or straining against the resistance of the machine. His body's shaking, right? His muscles are contorted in pain, he's pouring sweat, and on his face is an expression of total pain. This Martian would be absolutely convinced that just out of his range of vision is another fellow with a submachine gun who's forcing this character, you know, some bizarre form of torture. That's what he would conclude, wouldn't he? But you know what happens? If you step inside the room, if he steps inside the room, he finds no one forcing him. He's not paying for this, you know that? He's paying for this, you know? And not only that, he's loving every moment, you know that? He's loving every moment. He's in bliss, this fellow. This fellow is busy developing the physique of a gorilla. He's loving every moment. And you know what he's loving? The pain itself. That's what he's loving. You know why? Because he knows that it's the effort and the pain that's building what he wants to build. Can you feel this? Anyone out there? Yeah. Simcha, happiness, is the inner response to doing what you have to be doing. When you're going where you have to be going and you're building what you have to be building, there's an inner expansion. It's got nothing to do with the expression on your face. On the contrary, when the expression on your face is one of difficulty and pain and effort and exertion, but the exertion is being made in the right direction, growth is always taking place against resistance. Growth always and only takes place against resistance. So when you're exerting resistance against, when you're exerting effort against the resistance in order to make the growth, and get, when you're moving along a road and the journey's difficult and your feet are aching and it's, but you're walking along the right road and you're getting to a longed for destination. So you relish the journey. Even though the journey may be painful, but there's a happiness, there's a sense of moving towards. That's what it is. Let's try and take it a bit further. Before we go a little further, let's just return to our starting points and see if we can start fitting things together. Is it a mitzvah to be happy? No. That's not an end point. It's not an end point that you try to be happy. On the contrary, you try to do what you have to do. You move along the road, you have to move along. You have to serve Hashem in the way you have to serve Him. The result will be simcha. The result is happiness. It's how you feel when you're doing it. You're not commanded to be happy. You're commanded to walk along this road to get to the right destination. If you're walking along the right road to the right destination, your heart will be singing within you. There's no commandment, you understand? They think that you have to be happy. So now go find a road that makes you happy. No matter which road, as long as it makes you happy. Do your own thing, my boy. That's not Judaism. Judaism is this is the road and that's the destination. If you're doing it and your neshama knows that that's where it has to be going, you will be happy. And of course you need the happiness. You need it. The reason that that fellow carries on pushing those weights, right, is because he's addicted to the pain because of its pleasure. You need it. You need it richly. It's very important. Does the Torah say you should be happy? You know what Ivdus Hashem Basimcha means? The verse we began with? Serve Hashem in happiness. So people think superficially it means you should be happy. That's not what it says. Read the words carefully. Ivdus Hashem Basimcha means serve and you'll be happy. It doesn't say be happy, don't worry, be happy. It doesn't say that. It says Ivdus Hashem. When you serve Him, it means you develop yourself and you move towards Him, towards the reflection of what it is that you should be and your relationship, but then you'll be happy. But the people in this generation conveniently forget the first word, which is the word of working. You've got to work on yourself and your relationships. But if you're working correctly, even though the expression on your face, again, may be expression of intense work, tachas es ashaloi, because you did not what? Ovadata, because you didn't serve Hashem v'simcha. That's the problem. Not because you weren't happy. The Jewish people are not being punished because of all... Not being punished with all the brutalities that history has thrown at us because we were not happy. It doesn't say that. It says because you didn't serve in happiness. That's the important word. You know what the Chazon Ish means? Mitzvah. You know when he says, Ein etzev ba'olam, that there's no sadness in the world? That's what he means. The Chazon Ish didn't forget about sitting on the floor in mourning. But even in that incredible extreme, if a person is sitting on the floor, listen to this paradox, and this extreme paradox. A person is nevach lo yaleinu sitting on the floor and mourning about somebody who's died. The inexperience, if you're doing that correctly, should be an experience, and there's no etzev, there's no sadness at all. You know what? Let's get it clear. Stay carefully with me. First of all, you know the difference between English is not sensitive enough for our needs here. In English, you have to say there's a distinction between sadness and depression. Etzev in Hebrew means depression. It means the feeling of end. Point despair, hopelessness. That's what etzev means. The word etzev in Hebrew, right? Atzlut in Hebrew and atzvut are very closely related. Atzvut means depression. Atzlut means a stagnant non-movement. That's what it is. Atzvut, etzev, when the Chazon Ish doesn't say that there's never any crying in the world, or there's never an experience of mourning, he doesn't say that. And etzev means there's no experience of depression if you know what's happening. What he means is, if every moment of your life you're moving along the road, at sometimes on that road the sun is shining and you feel an easy sense of relaxation and happiness. Sometimes you're moving on the road and it's a storm and you're being lashed by the rain and the wind is beating you back and you're crying with the effort of... But if you're walking along the road and you know that no matter what the circumstances, it's the right road and you're getting to where you have to get and you're going to make it in time, no matter what the expression is on the face, the inner experience is happiness. When you sit on the floor and mourn for someone, you know why we mourn? Again, this is not our subject tonight. But you know why you observe the laws of mourning? You know why you take your shoes off and you sit on the floor and you do the actions of mourning? The Rambam says incredibly that the reason you do that, the way he phrases it is almost unbelievable. He said that somebody who fails to mourn for a relative who's died is conducting themselves with cruelty. It's cruel. You know why? Because the Kabbalistic tradition teaches that the mitzvah of mourning is the mitzvah of accompanying the person on their journey. You see, we look at things so egocentrically, we're so selfish, we think that the mitzvah of mourning is because it makes you feel better. It's a good psychological way of adjusting. You know, you deal with it. That happens to be true, but that's not the reason. The deeper sources say that the reason that you mourn, and that's why relatives mourn, is because since you are connected to that neshama by being related, when that person goes through the changes in the next world, which are very difficult and painful, they're accompanied on that journey, and their journey is made easier and it's lightened if somebody's related to them actually goes through the process. In fact, there are deep sources that say that in the stages of mourning, the first 3 days, the second 4 days, the first 7 days in general, there's a certain kind of emotion, certain things you go through. The next 30 days, the first 30 days, a different thing, the first year. You know why you go through those changes? You don't go through those changes because emotionally it gets easier and your emotions settle and you forget. You know why? Because as that person in that world goes through the changes they're going through, you are resonating with their neshama and you're going through the same changes. That's why you feel the changes that you go through. There are Kabbalists, there are deep works that talk about exactly the changes that the soul goes through and how the relative who's behind, who's going through that mourning. This is not our subject now. But the point is this, that even in extreme situation of mourning, if you understand that you're helping that person who can no longer help themselves, and that you're carrying them and you're doing this for them, huh? Even in that moment, could you feel a tremendous sense of expansion? You're crying tears, you're sitting on the floor, you're doing the act of mourning. But inwardly you have this intense security and happiness, in that strange word, of knowing that you're doing exactly what you have to be doing now, and there's nothing you could be doing that's better, and this is what Hashem wants from you, and this will have an eternal repercussion. Can you see that even in that extreme situation, there could be a very intense knowledge of doing what you have to be doing, and the neshama could have that sense of expansion that paradoxically we could all simcha. That doesn't mean you're sitting on the floor feeling happy, right, because somebody's died. We're not to use the words in a silly fashion. We don't mean that. But we mean there could be a very deep and mature and rich sense of purpose being fulfilled. Huh? In the crude example we gave before, akin to the fellows pushing weights, which is all pain, but he understands that this is what the moment demands, and he understands that this is taking where he wants to be going. That's the experience. That's the feeling. Let's go a little further. It's a complex subject, many, many layers. Okay, let's try and work it out. Let's take the next step. Let's go a little deeper. First of all, is the principle clear? Let's go a little deeper. What is the feeling, listen well, stay with me, concentrate with me. What is the feeling of moving along the road to the destination? What is the feeling exactly? Why is there this paradox? Why is it that when your muscles are aching and you're stressing yourself against you, you're going through an emotionally difficult situation of pain, loneliness, human ordeal, you've been abandoned, somebody's died, whatever it is. Why is it that if you're doing correctly what you have to be doing here and you're building what you have to be building, got the maturity to know that if you're constructing what has to be constructed, why is it that there's this response of simcha? Why? Where does it come from? Let's look more deeply. In other words, when you're building that pile of whatever it is you're building, you're carrying the rocks and the bricks, and it begins to take shape, why is there that exhilaration within you? Why? Listen carefully. Can you see that it is the pleasure of the anticipation of the end point? Can you see that? Can you see that the journey derives its happiness? You're not happy because you're sitting on a train going clickety-click, clickety-click, clickety-click. That doesn't make you happy. Even though it's hot and you're uncomfortable. You know what's making you happy? It's the relishing of the anticipation of getting where you're going to. You know why the fellow picking up those weights is feeling good while he's doing it? You know why the pain feels good? Because in his mind the pain is being translated into the way he'll look at the end of this process, assuming you want to look like that. Are you with me? There's an anticipation. The simcha of the journey derives from the feeling of the end point. How can we prove that? Let me try and prove that to you. Imagine you're carrying these bricks and these logs, but you've been told that just a second before you get it all completed, somebody's going to come and destroy the whole thing. How would you feel as you carry the bricks and the log? Would you feel pleasure? You would feel absolute sense of torture. Can you see that? Exactly the same feeling in terms of the agony and the work and the time, but there would be no pleasure at all. Imagine going on a journey, an urgent journey, with a sensation of urgency, and you know that it's going to go round and round and you're never going to get there. Just as you're about to get there, you're going to take a turn and go away, and you're going to... Would you enjoy the journey? Would be terror, sheer terror, such a journey. In case you want to be really terrified, the Gaon of Vilna says, the Gaon of Vilna writes clearly in a letter to his family, he writes that again, I'm not going to go into detail about the actual the particulars, but he writes about the sin of wasting words. The sin of, it's a sin. It's an avera to waste words. Not to say wrong words, or harmful words, or hurtful words, or lies. Just to say nonsense, to talk nonsense is an avera. It's part of the bigger avera of wasting time. You have a day of your life, and you do nothing with that day. That's a very serious problem. It's a very serious problem. Listen well. He writes, you have to understand it's a very serious problem, and it's also, okay, many layers here, but one thing at a time. He writes to his family, do you know what the punishment is for wasting time? Do you know what the punishment is for talking nonsense? I'm not talking about Lashon Hara, I'm not talking about slander, I'm not talking about unclean language, I'm not talking about hurtful things, I'm talking about talking nonsense. Do you know what he says the punishment is for each word of nonsense? For each word, the punishment is that in the next world, there's a special dimension of punishment that you feel for that. And the punishment is called kafakela. It's a Kabbalistic notion. Kafakela means the cup of the slingshot. You know the place where the missile is put in the sling. Yeah. Why? Because it indicates the experience of being slung or flung from one place to another, but just before arriving at the destination, to being flung again to another place. And just before arriving at that destination, just before being able to come home, to be flung again to another place, and it never ends. Why is that the punishment? It's a separate punishment. The punishment for telling lies and for hurting people and for being brutal and all the other avaros in the Torah, for being immoral, it's a special punishment for that, whatever it is. But for wasting time and wasting words, there's this particular unique and separate punishment. Why? You know that in Judaism, the concept of punishment is always the consequence of the action. You know that. We don't have any sense of punishment that's visited upon you. Our sense of reward and our sense of punishment is the action itself is what you experience. Our concept of the next world is that it's just you. And whatever you did is what you experience. It is you. We call it midah keneged midah, that measure for measure, right? It's exact measure for measure. Do you know why a person who wastes time experiences as a result the experience of being flung from one place to another but never getting there? Isn't that what wasting words is? Isn't that what wasting time is? Imagine you have a day. A day of your life is incredibly precious. Do you know what a day is worth? Do you know what one day of your life is worth? Do you know what a dying person would give for one more day? Anything. And you took it and you just killed it? If you go to sleep, if you can sit on your bed at night and you can say to yourself, where am I different now than I was this time last night? If you cannot genuinely say that some change occurred, that somehow you got a little bit better, you just wasted a day. That's a form of suicide. You took a day and you killed it. You did nothing with that day. The day was given as an incredible, priceless opportunity. One of a limited and finite number of days that you've been given to achieve something. But you didn't achieve it. What were you doing? You were moving along a road which is called your life, but it was to no destination. What was meant to be achieved by that journey, you weren't achieving. The punishment is, the consequence is, the emotion of going through the experience of traveling towards some place, which is what your life's supposed to be, but before getting there, you travel again. It's not a punishment, it's the consequence. That's who you became. You spent your life moving and moving and moving with your wheels spinning. Again, the happiness of the journey is the anticipation of the end point. The reason that it feels, the reason you feel the simcha, is because you know that this work is getting you to where you have to get to, and that's the simcha. Now stay with me for another moment. What's the happiness of the end point? You have to ask that question. After all, yeah, if the journey is an experience of anticipation of the end point, that's why you feel the happiness of the journey. One second. What's the happiness of the end point? When you get there, why you know what the happiness of the end point is? The appreciation of the journey that got you there. Can you see that? When this thing has been built, and you stand there and you look at this incredible thing that you built, you know what glow fills you? What? I did that. I achieved that. That was an incredible challenge and I achieved it. Can you see what's happening? You look back on the hours and hours and hours of work and agony. Isn't that amazing? The happiness of the journey is the anticipation of the end point. The happiness of the end point is the appreciation of the journey that got you there. You know, when that fellow who looks like a super whatever, you know, multiple gorilla, you know, thing, when he stands there, right, flexing those mistake. You know what makes him feel good then? the recollection of the hours and hours and hours of work and sweat and toil that it was invested to get you. And that's why the Gemara says that a person would rather have one thing that they made themselves rather than mine that they were given for free. On the contrary, when you're given a thing for free, not only don't you appreciate it, you even feel the shame of giving the handout. But it's a thing you built yourself. Can we take it one step further? Are we together so far? Let's take it one step further. Listen well. Again, there's nothing more important than this. I can guarantee you. The simcha of the journey is because it's moving towards an end point. The simcha of the end point is because of the work you put in the journey to get you there. Where does this derive from? Why is that so? Again, we have to ask questions. Why is that so? And I'll tell you why. Because every journey, right? And it's inexpressible in its beauty. Huh? Every bit of a journey, every little thing that you build, every road that you take, every work that you do with your body, every little bit of a journey towards a goal carries with it some of the happiness of being alive. And every endpoint that you reach, every achievement that you can look at and say, I did that and I perfected it, has some of the happiness of being in the next world after this life. You know why? Life is a journey, and the next world is the destination. Life is the journey, and the next world is the destination. Life is the work and the agony and the pain that is put in to make you who you are, which you'll be forever. The happiness of life is nothing other than the knowledge that every day has been built to get you to what you have to be and you will be eternally. And you know what the happiness of the next world is? That's my life. Do you know what the happiness is of an neshama in the next world? It's that, you know, the sources say that our concept of the next world is simply that you are exposed to yourself. That's all. You don't see anybody else. You know that? It says in the next world, every individual is entirely alone. Except husband and wife. Husband and wife are bonded into one being. It's good news for some of us, it's problematic for others. But I don't know what the men are laughing for. But, yeah. If anybody has cause concern, it's not you, it's her. But take it from me. But apart from that, right, then that's because husband and wife really were destined to be one being. They really were one being before they were born. They were given the job of melting back into being one being again. But that's not our subject. The subject is that an individual in the next world is entirely alone. Do you know what that means? All you exist as in the next world is simply who you've become. And all you see clearly is what you could have been. The incredible ecstasy of the next world is being who you have become, because you did that. It's you and you made it. The incredible pain of the next world is suddenly realizing what you could have been and realizing that you didn't do it. You see who you are and what you could have and should have been, and you see it clearly, and now you can't do it. Again, it's only you. So what is it? This world is the journey that takes you to being yourself, what you should be, in total fulfillment and completion. So the happiness of life is that it's an incredible opportunity to become, once in all of the cosmic expanse of time. This is your opportunity to become everything that you could be. This is unbelievable happiness. Then the neshama feels in every moment of life the incredible anticipation of being eternally what it should be in perfection, unified with Hashem. And you know what the happiness is? It's the knowledge that when I get there, the happiness there will be the knowledge that I did it in this lifetime, and that's what... Amazing thing. And therefore, every journey is a microcosm. We've spoken many times here before about how every emotional experience in life is an educational experience about that which transcends it. Every moment of journey in this world carries with it a little bit of the happiness of the journey of life itself. And every moment of endpoint in this world, you know that no matter how silly the thing that you built, no matter how small and insignificant, if you built it and you made it and it's complete, the happiness that derives there is derived from the sensation of eternal existence in the next world. That's what lights and informs this moment. It's an incredible thing. Are we together? Can you see that? And that's why the experience of happiness is so real. It derives from the most real of all things, which is the experience of... Let's take it further. Let's go further. let's take it further. You know what the happiness of the end point is? Let's ask that. Why is it that when you get to the end point, which is what the next world is, why is that happy? What is the simcha there? This is take a long time to work out fully, but let's at least try and point the way. The derivation of that is what we call the sensation of ptur. Ptur in Hebrew means exemption. The moment of exemption, you see, this life is obligation. It's pushing against resistance, right, as an obligation. The happiness of the next world is the moment of exemption. There's no more obligation. You know, when somebody dies, in Hebrew we say they're niftar. In English you can't say that. In English it means dies. In Hebrew, niftar means they become exempt of all obligation. Niftar, they become free of obligation. They're unlocked and exempt. You have to understand this. The transition from this world to the next carries with it the incredible happiness of the moment of exemption. Can you feel, for example, the moment that the final school bell rings? Or the moment that you finally lock the doors of the workplace, right, and now you're on vacation? That moment is an incredible moment of happiness. Why are you happy? Nothing happens. You're just standing there. No physical pleasure. You're just standing there. But you're free. Can you see what's happening? In the moment of having a load of obligation suddenly lifted. Are you with me? Not too many, huh? The first 5 minutes when you hit the beach, and after long hard work, that you really deserve. The first 5 minutes when you hit the beach and collapse, what exactly is the pleasure? You know what the pleasure is? Total, absolute lack of any obligation to do anything or be anywhere. It only lasts 5 minutes, then you start making a nuisance of yourself and getting bored and make everybody sick. But that's another problem. But it's another issue. But can you feel this? In the transition from load-bearing into the space of not having to go anywhere is an incredible moment of freedom. Do you know that? And that's, again, marriage has certain aspects of this and certain reflections, unfortunately, is not able to go into it here. But incidentally, do you know where you feel this in Jewish living? There are two places in Judaism that reflect this perfectly. One is Torah and one is Shabbos. In the world of Torah, it's Torah learning, and in the world of mitzvahs, it's Shabbos. What is Shabbos? What is Shabbat? Shabbos is a day of not having to go anywhere or do anything. It's total freedom of, total exemption from. Shabbos is that you can't build or prepare anything. You have to only live on what was prepared before. It's a day of just being. That's what its happiness is. Do you understand? Shabbos is a day where you desist from all the working to build and create, and you just live as who you really are. That's why it's a day of such intense communion with yourself, husband and wife, family. It's just an awareness of who you've become. The week is working and becoming. Shabbos is simply being. It's a return to the moment of creation. Do you understand what's happening? When the sun goes down on Shabbos, and everything stops, there's a crescendo of activity, and suddenly it stops. The happiness of that day is a time out of time. It's a place where there's no place to go. You sit, you are, you exist. There's a rich sense of enjoying. And that's the happiness of Torah learning. Torah we learn not in order to get any place. We don't learn Torah so that you can do or be something. We learn Torah lishma, for its own sake. There's a sensation when you learn Torah of being in a place that is the ultimate end of the journey. Is this clear? You should not be learning Torah because you're going to use the knowledge for anything else. That's also true. You need that as well. But the ultimate level of Torah learning is that you do it for its own sake. Am I making this clear? The happiness of it, the incredible ecstasy of learning Torah, of sitting in the base medrash and learning Torah, you're dripping with pleasure. Why? Because you're in a place that it's own justification. It doesn't carry. It's incredibly hard work, but that's irrelevant. That's where the happiness is. Yeah. You need to come and learn in yeshiva for a while. You know that the word yeshiva is a very strange word. The word yeshiva is a very strange word. It means to sit. Yeshiva is a place where you sit. You sit and learn. What a weird name. The Jewish people don't use words inaccurately. Why don't we name the place where you learn Torah something to do with the learning? Do you hear the problem? Why do we name it by such a peripheral detail as the fact that it's a place where you sit? I mean, stand. Lie down. Stand on your head. What's the difference? Not only that, the word sitting in Hebrew always means sadness. You know that? You say you sit shiva. Sitting down, vayeshev, right? Vayeshev. All the commentaries say that's when Yaakov's troubles really began. Vayeshev, sitting down. sitting. You know why? Because it's non-movement. It's non-movement. Walking and moving is what life's all about. When you try to sit down, that's a function of the next world. If you sit down in this world, it's pain and sadness. It's always negative. So how come we name the place where we learn Torah, which is the ultimate existence here, as close as you can get to being in the next world, we call it a yeshiva, which means sitting, and that implies sadness. The sadness of non-movement and stagnation and sitting in one place. Can you hear the problem? But the answer is beautiful. Beautiful. You can't sit down in this world. This world is walking and moving. There's only one place you can sit in this world. That's in Torah. When you're learning Torah, you know what you're doing? You're sitting on a rocket ship. That's what you're doing. Any other place, you're walking. You're walking. But you're walking against the storm, and it's three steps forward and two steps back, and you're lashed and beaten by the rain. You don't even know. This is one place where you're sitting down. You're working hard, believe me. You're working harder than any other place. But the vehicle is moving. That's one place where you're sitting. You're doing the next world. That's what Torah is, because it's a timeout of this world. Do you know where you feel this universally? You know what is the idea of playing a game? A game is defined, like the definition of a game, is an activity that's its own justification. You don't play a game because of a you don't play a game for, again, a real game is that which you play for the pleasure of simply playing the game. Can you see this? Of course you can play games for reasons. But the pleasure of a real game, and by the way, that's why the games that are the most meaningless and trivial are the most enjoyable. You know that? People sit around playing a game, and it's a delicious experience. What are they doing? They're sitting around, you know, they're going backwards and forwards and up and down and backwards and this way and that way and they're back again and up and down for 3.5 hours. And it's delicious. Delicious. 3.5 hours in which utterly nothing occurred. That's a delicious experience. You know why? Because they carved out a little space in time that had no obligation attached. There was no obligation of journey. There was no process necessary or experienced. There was the experience of endpoint. There was a little bit of the experience of the next world. Do you know what the Medrash says? The Medrash asks what Hashem is doing with his time. What does God, what does Hashem do with his time? Do you know what the Medrash says? He's playing with the Torah. He's Mishta Asher Im HaTorah. He plays with the Torah. What does it mean? The word game in Hebrew, Sha'ashua, means that which is justified in itself. It's an endpoint in itself. That's the appropriate word to use to describe activity of Torah. Hashem, who is ultimate endpoint, with his Torah, which is the definition of endpoint, what verb could you use other than playing a game? Not to be heard yet at a childish level, of course. I mean, you know, the word shashua in Hebrew is a remarkable word. Shashua means a game. It's an incredible Hebrew word. It's a doubled root. Very few words like that in Hebrew. Shashua in Hebrew is spelled sha-sha. It's a doubled root. It's very remarkable. Do you know what sha means in Hebrew? To turn towards. Like it says, when Michas Kain lo sha, he didn't turn towards the gift, right? You know what sha-sha means? Turning towards the turning towards. That's what the word means. Because that's what a game is. It's entirely justified within itself. Did I tell you the story of my friend's children who were playing Monopoly?
Yeah.
You'll forgive me if I repeat it. I have a friend who told me that one morning he was leaving the house and he saw his kids playing Monopoly. And Friday afternoon the same week he was getting ready for shul, he saw the kids were playing the same game Monopoly all week, and so he walked over to them very paternalistically and he said, kids, you don't understand how to play Monopoly. The way you play Monopoly is you can't keep playing all week, somebody has to win. What happens is, you know, somebody buys the property and somebody goes out of business and someone else goes out of business until everybody's out and one person has a monopoly of all the property and he wins, you know. I said to him, no, Abba, you don't understand. You know what we do? When one of us goes out of business, all the others get together and we make a gemach, a free loan fund. And we lend them money and set them back up in business and we carry on playing. If your kids play like that, that's the way games should be played. Well, what, you think you're playing to win? So then the game's over. That's a real understanding of a game. That's a deep understanding. And that's the deliciousness. That's why the worst thing you can do in life is waste time, because you're wasting your life. And that's why it's so delicious. That's why when you're doing nothing, Huh? People are sitting and talking absolute nonsense.
Absolute nonsense.
I'm sure it doesn't happen in England. But there are places where people can lie by the pool, you know, for 3 hours straight, 4 hours, 5 hours, and talk about who hit how many runs back in 19... That's relevant? Makes any difference? It's delicious. People go out and they sit and talk, you know? Sit and talk for hour after hour after. By the time they get to end the conversation, they can't even remember how they got there or how they started. But it's completely irrelevant. It makes no difference. It is delicious. You know why? Because nothing happened. Because there was an experience of time out of time. There was a little zone of the ultimate existence of the next world. It's an incredible thing. Of course, this is not the time for it. It's not the time for it while you're here. Here you need small doses just to keep you going. You need Shabbos every week. You need the occasional experience of a timeout to remind yourself what it is. Of course you need that. But you only need it to keep you motivated to keep walking along the road. The time for the real sitting down, and that would be plenty of time for that. Plenty of time. Okay, are we together? Can we take one more step? Let's understand depression. It should be obvious now. You know what's the cause of depression? The cause of depression is when the soul feels that it's not going where it should be going. When you're not developing, when you're not doing what you should be doing, you will be depressed. Can you see? I'm not talking about chemical depressions and medical problems and genetic. I'm talking about functional depression. When a person, if the soul knows, if the neshama knows that it's not going anywhere, right? That a day went by and a week went by and a month went by and a year went by and you're no different than you were a year ago, and 1 year of your life has gone and you're no different, and it'll never come again, you have to be depressed. Do you know what the feeling of depression is? Listen well, please, stay with me. What is the feeling of simcha? A tiny touch of the ecstasy of the next world, of achievement. Do you know what the feeling of depression is rooted in? The feeling of death. Can you see that? It's a little bit of death. After all, if a person lived 120 years and then they are not here anymore, it's the end, right? Well, what if a person lived through a year in which they did nothing? It's a year of death. Then the neshama feels the cold hand of death when it is... Again, how would you feel if you're on a road and you're walking in the wrong direction along that road, or you're walking round and round in circles? It becomes apparent to you that you've been laboring and struggling and walking and you've been going round and round and round in circles. How would you feel? You'd feel the tremendous pain of all the work that was put in and all the effort and all the time, and it didn't get you anywhere. When that's how your life is going, your neshama gets depressed and unavoidable. You know what's the cure for depression? Get moving. How do you get moving? Yeah, there's a little secret. And the secret is that what we want is real movement, inner movement. But unfortunately, it's not possible to get moving inwardly when you're depressed. The only solution is, it's a very deep Jewish principle, and I can't go into now the details, you get the outer dimension moving, and it will schlep with the, it's called chitzonius moireis apnimius. The outer awakens the inner. That's the principle. You get the outer body moving, and it will awaken the inner neshama. Is this clear? If somebody's morbidly depressed, and you walk up to them and you say, "Be happy," okay, they will not be happy. They will begin weeping. That's their problem, is that they can't be happy. No, you don't do that. You walk up to them and you say, "Let's go for a run." Better still, let's go do something for somebody else. Ooh, that's powerful. And they do it morbidly and morosely. But when they get moving and the juices start flowing and the body starts moving, they feel like, next time you feel miserable, lock the door, because if people see you doing what I'm about to describe, you'll have more serious problems on your hands. Lock the door, okay? When you're sure that nobody's watching, okay, walk around for 5 minutes with a very big grin on your face. Fix the biggest, stupidest grin that you can do. Walk around for, you know what will happen? You'll find a strange thing starts happening to your mood. It's very hard to cry while you're smiling. You have to get the externality to awaken the internality. You've got to behave as if you're happy. You've got to start moving the outer world, and the inner world will move. That's what you have to do. But it doesn't matter. The principle is, that's just the technique and the mechanism that requires a separate discussion. Why and how? Very deep reasons for it. But the principle is that when the inner world is moving, when there's growth and development, it does not matter how difficult. On the contrary, because it's difficult, the experience inwardly will be the experience of sinful. Is this clear? There's one alternative. There's one way out of this. Let's say a person has this fear, this depressive, this feeling. Please, hear carefully. Maybe you'll say to me, but I know people who are not growing and they're not depressed. I know people who are not doing anything meaningful with their lives. And they're happy as larks. Go and observe carefully. You know what you'll find? Listen well. Either a person's achieving and that's why they're happy, or they're not achieving and they're depressed, or they're achieving something silly. They've sublimated the drive to achieve into something irrelevant. But it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. Your emotions can't tell the difference. Again, if you're building something that looks meaningful, and you're working hard and something's taking shape, it's enough to keep you functioning, and people... Is this clear? This is why people go out there and they dedicate their lives to things that objectively examined are stupid. But you know why? Because they need to be dedicated to something, and they need to be working and building. And it doesn't matter whether it's feed the children, or feed the elephants, or save the seals, or save the mothers-in-law, or what. It doesn't matter what it is. But if it's... And that's why this person can be making an art collection, or it's a world-famous art collection, or it can be a beer can collection. And you know the characteristic of a Jew. What difference between a non-Jew and a Jew in these things? Is Jews take these things seriously. The Jewish boy makes a beer can collection. That's it, every beer can in the world. And then he starts a magazine and a fan club and a web page and a... Why? Because the Jewish neshama is attached to serious development. And therefore, it doesn't matter what it is. And it can be to be a world famous world thing in literature or in art or in this or that or a collection. It can be beer cans, matchboxes. It makes no difference. There's a sublimation of the need to move towards and achieve and build and perfect. And it can be sublimated into that which is utterly meaningless and stupid, but it's enough to kill you. Because it supplies enough of the need to achieve and build that you don't feel anymore, and the neshama thinks it's getting fed. Is this clear? Can we go a little further? Got more energy? Let's take one more step. One more step. What is the feeling of simcha itself? Again, this is long and complex. I'm going to try and just touch on a few points that are... What is the feeling itself? Again, we've discussed its derivation and what generates it, and we've discussed a lot of angles of the subject, and I hope you've got a more... I hope I've given you something to think about, and you've got a fresh angle, perhaps, on this subject, at least a more authentically Jewish vision of the subject. But let's try and take one final step. What is the experience itself? Not what causes it and why and how. What is the experience itself? Please try and stay with me. The experience of simcha, the experience itself of simcha, is an experience of expansion. It's a sense of going from a more straitened or more constrained situation to a more expanded situation. Can you feel that? There's an expansion of consciousness. The mind expands. When you go from a situation of work and difficulty towards the situation of endpoint, there's a situation of expansion or transcendence. Can you feel that? First of all, if you look at people who are happy, look at somebody during the simcha, you'll notice that their world suddenly enlarges. They suddenly put their arms out and take in people who wouldn't have been that close to them otherwise. Have you ever seen that? There's an expansion of world. And you know what depression is? It's a shrinking in of the world. The world shrinks. Do you know, I'll just give you an example. Do you know what the mitzvah of Nichum Avelim is? The mitzvah of comforting mourners. It's a mitzvah to comfort mourners. You know what the mitzvah consists of? You know what the mitzvah consists of? People don't know this, it's tragedy. The mitzvah consists of going to see the person, you sit down in front of them and say nothing. You're not allowed to speak to them. Do you know that? You're not allowed to speak to the person. You sit there and say nothing. And if they wish to speak to you, then they speak to you and you enter conversation. If they don't, you sit there. Wow. First of all, they may not feel like speaking. You're not there to be a burden on them. But you know why? Because you know what they're suffering? They're suffering a tremendously shrunken world. So you sit there to be an opportunity for them to move out of that inner world. That's all. You sit there inviting them out. You don't impose on them. That's the last thing they need. You sit there as an opportunity for them to come out, and you want to re-expand their world. Because if you re-expand, then the inner expansion will take place. There's more to it than that, but that's the beginning. Let's see if we can feel this. It's hard to find the words, but is the point expansion? There's a moving out of the limited constraints of the difficulty of the journey to the broadness and the expanse of the result. Incidentally, you should know, that's why the Torah sources do refer to this world as long and the next world as broad. Isn't that incredible? This world is always called long. Aruka me eretz mida. The Torah is longer than the land. Rechava min hayam, but it's wider than the ocean. The mida means its measure is 49. Mem daladha is 49. Rechava min hayam, but broader than the ocean is yud mem 50. This world is always called 49 steps, and the next world is always called the 50th. At which transcends the steps. That's called broad. There's no place to go. It's not long. Long means there's a step after another step after another step. That's called long. But the next world is called wide. There's no place to go. It's just wide. Just expand. Is this clear?
No.
Let me see if I can try and demonstrate this. The word simcha in Hebrew, I just want to show you a couple of examples and we'll stop. The word simcha in Hebrew has the same letters as chamisha, which means five. You know, again, Hebrew is a precisely scientific language. The word simcha in Hebrew is the same letters as chamisha, which means five. What's the connection between five and happiness? There's a lot of very deep connection. I just want to share with you one. The Maral says that four always means the constrained and the sad. The word dalad in Hebrew, which means four, you know, dalad, the fourth letter, means poverty, having nothing, being totally constrained. Five is always where the limited expanded, the limited non-expanded physical world has an extra dot, an extra dimension thrown in that gives it its expansion. Do you know that a dalad in Hebrew is like this? Dalad is two lines at right angles, right? Which indicates the four dimensions, what we call the two-dimensional worlds, right? The four, right, left, forward and back. How do you make a dalad into a hay? You just put one extra dot in. The deeper sources say that it's a line seen end on. It gives expansion into the third dimension. But it's the extra dot that makes the dalad into a hay, and the hay is the letter that the next world is created with. The sound of the breath. When four moves to five, right, there's an expansion from the straightened narrowness to the five books of the Torah. By the way, you know what six is? You know what six is? Shesh in Hebrew is six. Do you know it's the same word as sas, which means ecstasy? You see, when four goes to five, you get simcha. When five goes to six, that means when happiness expands to its transcendent level, then you get a thing called sason, which is much higher than what simcha is. When six goes to seven, what's seven in Hebrew? Shiva. You know what shiva spells in Hebrew? Svi'ah. It means complete fullness. The word itself, the word seven in Hebrew means, you know, seven is always the full expansion, right? 7 days in the week. That is a total satiety, satiation, fullness, right? That's what Sheva means, Svi'ah, fullness. What's eight, by the way, which is what Chanukah is?
Shmone.
Shmone in Hebrew means, the word Shmone in Hebrew, which means eight, always indicates that which transcends the natural. That's why there's 8 days of Chanukah, because it celebrates a miracle. Bris Milah on the eighth day, because we're transcending the body, the most earthy part of the body, we're giving the ability to transcend. That's why the word Shmone in Hebrew, if you rearrange the letters, it spells Neshama, the soul. Actually, if you rearrange the letters of Shmone, it spells Neshama. And if you rearrange the letters in the other way, it spells Mishnah. The Mishnah is the level where the Torah makes contact with its transcendent, the oral and the written law are making contact. Yeah? All the same idea. Of course, the word Shmone, is the root of it is Shemen, which means oil. Which is what Chanukah is. So we eat foods that are in the oil of the light of the... The Arizal says that the nefesh, the soul of the human being, nefesh is nun pei shin, which spells ner psil shemen, the light, the wick, and the oil. Ner Hashem nishmas Adam, this candle of Hashem is the soul of a human being. And that's what the word nefesh spells. It spells the flame, the wick, and the oil. That's what it is. So shemen is oil. And you know what oil means? Shemen in Hebrew means fat, oil or fat. You know what fat is? Not just fullness like seven, but expanding beyond the minimal fullness, right? That's shaman. Nine is even higher, Taisha, it's very deep. And ten, nine means Perhaps another time we can talk about it more. But it indicates another step in this process which moves towards the ten. In fact, Tesha is based on the word Sha, which we mentioned before, which means moving towards. And ten in Hebrew, Eser, is the same word as Ashir, which means riches, rich. It's not only fullness or even more than full, it means being able to pour out onto others as well. That's what. I mean, you see it right in the words. But let me take one more example. I want to give you two more examples. Can I do it? Two more and we'll stop with that, okay? Two examples and we'll stop. You probably won't believe me about this example because it sounds so wild. But I'll tell you anyway. What aspect of the world, stay with me and try and do the thinking for me, with me. What aspect of the physical world most denotes the limitation of the world? That means there's a concept that we use all the time that very much speaks of utter limitation. It's the concept of measurement. Isn't that so? When you measure a thing, you give it a total finite boundary. This thing is measured, and it has its measure. Right? Can you see that? That is totally fixed within the physical. How do measurements work in Torah? How do measurements work? What are our feet in inches or centimeters or listen well, because this is... There's just no words for the beauty and subtlety of this. Do you know how we measure things by unit, for example, called a tefach, right? A tefach is a hand's breadth. That is 9.8 centimeters or 10 centimeters. And an amah is 6 of them, right? 48 or 50 etfachim. How much is a tefach? Listen carefully. In the secular world, they use measurements. For example, a meter, not feet and inches or meters. How much is a meter? How much is a meter? You know how much a meter is? In Paris, in the Institute of Standards, they have a bar of platinum that's 1 meter long. And that's the international standard for the meter. You know that? They keep a bar of platinum under incredibly tightly controlled conditions of temperature and pressure, etc., etc. And from there, the world takes its standard. And of course, there has to be a standard. Imagine if you had slightly different standards all over the place. Things would be a disaster. So the world has agreed that there's one standard, and every measurement on earth is taken from that standard. How does it work in Judaism? Are there any engineers here? You're not going to believe me. I'll tell you anyway. How does it work in Judaism? We have a tefach, okay? How big is a tefach? The answer is, it depends. Depends. The Gemara says there's two kinds of tefachim. Listen carefully, it's incredible. There's a thing called a tefach like this, which is called a tefach atzuv, a sad tefach. And then there's a tefach like this, where the fingers are slightly spread, and it's called a tefach seichek, a smiling tefach. Just let's get this clear. We've got two kinds of measurements. We've got sad ones, and ones that are slightly expanded that are happy. Next time you get a contractor and you want him to make something, tell him you want this made out of happy feet. What's going on? What engineer in his right mind would devise a system of measurements where the measurements can either be constrained and narrow, and we call them sad, or they could be slightly expanded and we call them happy? What on earth is going on? But you know what's going on? You know what the Torah is telling you? That the very constraints of the physical world are the basis for its expansion and transcendence. In the very measure that we use, the units that constrain the world and make it finite, in Judaism, those can expand. What an unbelievable depth. Let me give you one final example, and we'll stop there. You know that one of the most ubiquitous symbols of anything we have in Judaism is wine. Yes? Wine. We take wine, we drink a lot of wine. You know where we take wine? At every moment of transition from the limited and narrow and physical to the expanded or miraculous or transcendent, right? That's where we take wine. Is that correct? When the week becomes Shabbos, the constraints of the physicality of the week become Shabbos, take a cup of wine. Two people are getting married, as two physical entities about to enter that which is marriage, which is transcendent and spiritual, take up one. Bris Milah circumcision, we're taking the body and giving it the ability to become transcendent and spiritual, we take a cup of wine. Etc., etc., etc. What is wine? Why wine? You know, we're so used to it that you don't even think. Two people are standing under the chuppah and there's a cup of wine. You're so used to it because you're a Jew. Hey, you know, but what's wine doing there? People are getting married, what's a cup of wine doing? Do you know what wine is? Wine is that substance that's created on earth that is enables you to go from the physical and limited to the spiritual and unlimited. First of all, you know Yain in Hebrew is Yud Yud Nun, it's equal 70. And Sod, the word meaning the secret world, is 70. So the sages say when wine goes in, the secret comes out. It doesn't only mean that you tell your secrets. It means that the hidden world is brought to the surface. Wine has the ability, you know, wine is that substance which you have too much of it, you become totally physical. It banishes entirely the spiritual. But if you have just enough of it, if it's used correctly, it expands the spiritual. Do you know wine is the only substance known? Do you know that the rules of the physical and the spiritual are opposite? The laws of physicality and spirituality are the opposite. Everything that's spiritual gets better with time, like wisdom. Everything that's physical gets worse with time, always. Always. The body winds down. Every single thing in the physical world gets worse with time, except wine. It's the only substance, do you understand, that obeys the rules of the spiritual, even though it's a physical substance. It's a vision into the hidden world. We take wine, yes, whenever we wish to take a physical reality, and we wish to bring out its inner spiritual transcendence, that's where we take wine. Because wine has that potential, unlike it. And therefore, every moment, a bris milah circumcision, we take wine. A marriage, two physical bodies, going to engage in marriage and elevate themselves to the spirituality of the relationship, we take wine. When Shabbos comes in, that's the physical limitation of the week, is now expanding into the next world dimension of Shabbos, we take a cup of wine. That's what it is. Now, there's only one difficulty with this whole discussion, and we'll finish with this. And the difficulty is Haftarah. Haftarah. That's a problem. Haftarah is, you know what Haftarah is? When we go from Shabbos back into the week, we step down. Take a cup of wine. That's a difficulty. Can you see the problem? Wine is the symbol and the agency and the transfer point, the interface between the physical in its elevation to the spiritual. So anytime we're going up into that expanded world, we take a cup of wine. Havdalah, we're going from the expanded world of Shabbos into the constraints and the physicality and the limitations of the week. Why do we take wine there? But the answer is, like always in Torah, there are no exceptions. No exceptions in Torah. Everything is always illustrating its principle. Please. Hear well. You know why we take wine when we walk down from Shabbos to down into the week? Because when you move down from Shabbos into the week, you know why you're doing it? You're doing it so that you can work hard through another week to arrive at a Shabbos that will be higher than the one you just lived. That's the real elevation. It's called Yirida Tzorech Aliyah, going down for the sake of going up. When you go down out of Shabbos, if you go through a week and you go back up into the same place you were before, and then you go down again and next Shabbos you're the same as you were before, that's not the idea. The idea of Shabbos is that you step down of it and you build so that the next Shabbos you're higher than you were the one before. And it's not a circle, it's a spiral. And you come down out of Shabbos, out of the rarefied atmosphere of the next world, into carrying the load and struggling through the storm on your road of the week of the next week, so you can go reach the next Shabbos higher than the one before. Do you know when is the real moment of elevation? Do you know when the real moment of elevation is? It's not when Friday night the sun goes down and you step from the week into Shabbos and you expand and you relax. That's just a time out where you're experiencing what the next world's going to be. You know when the real elevation is? It's when you step down out of Shabbos at Havdalah time and you shoulder the load again and you bear the burden and you start building and working. That's the real Simcha. The real elevation, the real transcendence, the real Simcha that wine speaks of, do you understand? Is the understanding that in this physical reality with all its constraints and walking along that storm-lashed road with all its difficulty and sensation of, but that's where the expansion is. That's exactly where we take wine. That's exactly where we take wine. We're not looking for the other side of wine. We're not looking for the forgetfulness and the lack of consciousness and the drunkenness. That's not our happiness. On the contrary, we're looking for the exertion. We're looking for pushing those weights and straining against the load and building what has to be built. That's what we're looking for. Because in that pain of stepping down and leaving the light behind, stepping down, that's what Simcha is. And of course, that's Chanukah. Chanukah is that the last time we saw anything miraculous was Chanukah. We left behind the world of prophetic revelation. That was the written law. And we move into Chanukah, which is the time of the oral law. We leave behind all the incredible prophetic miracles and the light of the Beis HaMikdash. And we move into a Chanukah, which is a tiny little light in the Jewish window that has to burn through century after century and take us through the Mashiach. the original light of the written law with its prophetic revelation and its miracles. We don't have that anymore. Right? We've stepped down now into the world of darkness, but that's where the real light can be lit. The first one is given. It's the second one that we do. And therefore, the path of a Jew in the world, we're not looking for forgetfulness and drunkenness and insensitivity. We're looking to bear the pain of the world and it's the knowledge of the world. And we're looking to engage difficulties. We're looking to walk along that road. We're looking to go down out of the rarefied atmosphere of the world that came before this or Shabbos into the world of the weak and the difficulty and the process of walking. We're looking to be racing against time, to building what has to be built. We can't afford to waste a day or a week or a month. And it's that experience of building without reference to the expression on the face, and most often because the expression on the face is one of difficulty, that the real building takes place.